Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and this is A Cult of Personality podcast episode number 106, featuring an interview with Paul Weston about his book, Aleister Crowley and the Aeon of Horus. Support for A Cult of Personality podcast comes from the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section, as well as the generous listeners from all over the world who clicked the donate button on the website to sponsor this particular episode. Thanks again to Ardovan, Steve, Michal from Slovenia, Christopher, Brian, and Bruce Hanafy at brucehanafy.com. Additional support was provided by Gnostic NYC.
Gnosticism is making a comeback, with new churches, movies and books with Gnostic themes, and a growing interest in the literature and practices of early Gnostic communities. We are Gnostic NYC, a center for esoteric spirituality and practice. We provide a place for Gnostics right in the heart of New York City, hosting Gnostic masses, seminars, rituals, study groups, meditation sessions, and more. If you're interested in learning how you can participate with Gnostic NYC, check us out online at GnosticNYC.com or call 4242-GNOSIS. That's 424-246-6747. Gnostic NYC, ancient religion for a modern age.
Now, in episode number 106, our guest is visionary, author, and lecturer Paul Weston. Paul lives in Glastonbury, England, and has authored three books, Avalonian Aeon, Mysterium Artorius, and the focus of our interview tonight, Aleister Crowley and the Aeon of Horus, a fascinating and wide-ranging analysis of the currents of history, Thelema, and magic during the 20th century. You can find Paul online at paulwestonglastonbury.com, avalonianaeon.blogspot.com, and Aeon is spelled A-E-O-N. That's avalonianaeon.blogspot.com. And be sure to check him out on the Avalonian Aeon Blog Talk radio show. Paul has extensively studied the work of Aleister Crowley and Thelema, and Paul's work conveys the mystery of the Western esoteric tradition in a very unique and entertaining manner. In this conversation, we focus primarily on Aleister Crowley, the Great Beast, 666, Thelema, the Aeon of Horus, the rise and fall of Nazi Germany, and the occult connections therein. Paul Weston, welcome to the show. It's really excellent to speak with you.
Pleasure for me to be here with you tonight as well, Greg, definitely.
I am an admirer of your work. I think your books and your Avalonian Aeon podcast are really very good ways for people to become familiar with the mysteries, the Western mysteries, and it's just fantastic.
Well, it's been a tremendous pleasure for me to manifest these works. My three books took 10 years to write pretty much all together. There was a lot of intensity and purpose there, and I always believed it was worthwhile, and I always believed that I had something worthwhile communicating.
For listeners who aren't already familiar with you and your work, would you just say a few words about yourself, your experience, and some of your interests that really led into the work that you do today?
Okay, well, I'm talking to you now from Glastonbury, which can readily be considered the mystical capital of the United Kingdom. And in that place, in this location, I think is a unique blend of the Christian tradition, the pagan tradition, the more specific occult Western mystery tradition, all of those kind of things have been in harmony and a unity during 30 years worth of study of comparative religion, Eastern and Western paths. You know, I had a university education where I got a degree in the study of comparative religion, worked as a hypnotherapist, studied all the usual suspects, Crowley, Dion Fortune, Gurdjieff and Aspensky, read lots of Colin Wilson books, read lots of Robert Anton Wilson books, certainly had a bit of an affinity for the likes of Timothy Leary. In the midst of all of that, I was very fortunate to hook up with this guy who's becoming increasingly well-known in America, the historical mysteries writer Andrew Collins. His last book, Beneath the Pyramids, detailed his discovery of the cave system beneath the Giza Plateau, which is one of the hottest topics in Egyptology at the moment. His work in something that he termed psychic questing threw me in at the deep end 20 years ago into a whole realm of remarkable paranormal, mystical and visionary experiences out in the landscape, and also connecting up with historical lineages of ideas and traditions. All of that is discussed in my autobiographical Avalonian Eon. And as well as that, I've gone through, you know, various yogic and Eastern paths. Very much consider myself to be a devotee, for example, of the Hindu Mother Meru, who's considered by some people to be an incarnation of the Divine Mother. I know that's a lot to take on board. I can only say that I've got major results out of giving her my attention. And my experiences in Glastonbury and of Crowley and Gurdjieff in the Western Mystery tradition were always inseparable, but when I tried to write them all down, I found that I'd got 1,000 pages on my hands and I had to break them into more manageable chunks. And therein is the root of my Arthurian Grail Glastonbury book, Mysterium Artorius, and Aleister Crowley and the Inner Horus.
Fascinating. Obviously, you are well-versed in these subjects, and you're not writing from simply a historical research perspective. You're writing also as someone who has immersed themselves in the theory and practices of these traditions as well.
I think I'm writing because my brain would explode if I didn't. You know, I think I'm writing because I'm explaining these things to myself. I'm coming to an understanding of them with ever greater depth through the actual process of writing about them, as well as years worth of reading and experiencing. The actual process of somehow attempting to communicate it to other people is another thing in itself that's very important and was simply an internal imperative with me that could not be ignored.
Now, the focus of our conversation today is primarily your book, Aleister Crowley and the Aeon of Horus, which I found to be just fascinating. For me personally, I felt like this book was just right up my alley. It touched on all the subjects in ways that I'd thought about but never fully understood in such a eloquent articulation that you put to it. Your own perspective on the historical research, the way things fit together, and I'd like to begin there because it really, the way you look at things really sets the stage for the entire text as more of a magical understanding of events and humans' place within them and how it all fits together.
I think the thing is, I've always been, since I was a fairly young child, a bit of a history freak. You know, I came to consciousness in the 60s. I was born in 1959. I was born from parents who were of the generation that had fought in the Second World War. And my earliest memories are of the early days of Beatlemania, A Summer of Love, 1967, The Tumult, gradually becoming aware of things like the Vietnam War and the death of Martin Luther King, and how groups like the Beatles and the Stones started to get a bit weird. And there was this kind of thing whereby these two decades that are only 20 years apart seem to be so incredibly different that the history books that I read just didn't really seem to give me a handle on it. And the extremities, if you like, of, on the one hand, the Nazi era, the Nazi nightmare, and then the psychedelic 60s, they seem to be so incredibly diverse and so fascinating to me, the feeling that there was some great mystery there, that there was a feeling underlying both of them, that I was looking to understand them. I was looking to find something that would get me a handle on them. And when I first started to read about Aleister Crowley in my late teens and my early 20s, and I heard about this idea of the Aeon of Horus, that started to ring bells with me. There was something about that that felt absolutely right. And this is all based on this legendary, notorious text, the Book of the Law, that Crowley and his wife Rose received in distinctly unusual circumstances in Cairo in 1904. It's a pretty famous story whereby they got their three chapters on three consecutive days dictated, it appears, by some kind of clairaudient voice that announced the coming of a new epoch, the end of the old Christian dispensation. And each one of those three chapters is very distinct. The first chapter, the words of the Egyptian sky goddess Nuit, they're absolutely beautiful. They're very poetic. And they conjure up a vision of 1967 and the summer of peace and love. I can imagine the sky goddess Nuit arched over that whole scene, you know, come forth, O children under the stars, take your fill of love. I'm above you and in you. My ecstasy is in yours. My joy is to see your joy. Take your fill and will of love as you will, when, where, and with whom you will, but always unto me. You know, I love you. I yearn to you. I who am all pleasure and purple and drunkenness of the innermost sense desire you. Put on the wings and arouse the coiled splendor within you. Come unto me. Now that really feels like it conjures up the best side of the psychedelic 60s. But then, of course, you know, the other extreme, the third chapter is absolutely ferocious, and it's got this, a whole bunch of stuff in it that the Book of the Law and Crowley and his followers have attracted some flack for because people don't necessarily quite understand it. You know, I'm a god of war and of vengeance. This is Ra Hor Kuit, who's a form of Horus. Thou shalt have danger and trouble. Worship me with fire and blood. And then mercy let be off. Damn them who pity. Kill and torture. Spare not be upon them. A whole bunch of stuff which really conjures up the ferocity of the Eastern Front and the Holocaust and, you know, the end of the Second World War, Hiroshima. So where's the unity between them? Now, the second chapter, the middle chapter, is the words of a form we call almost a metaphysical principle, Hadith, who says that he's the flame that burns in every heart of man and in the core of every star. I'm life and the giver of life, yet therefore is the knowledge of me the knowledge of death. I am the snake that giveth knowledge and delight and bright glory and stir the hearts of men with drunkenness and then the admonition to worship me, take wine and strange drugs, whereof I will tell my prophet. Now the thing that interests me here, how this landed with me and maybe not instantly when I first started reading this material in the late 70s, the early 80s, but certainly as we went through the 80s, I got the sense that, you know, the 20th century was characterised by the biggest expansion of our sense of reality in terms of science that we've ever had, the discovery of DNA, the unleashing of the atom, literally the flame that burns in every heart of star, in every heart of man, in the core of every star. You've got this sense of DNA, the atom bomb, and then at the same period of time, you know, within a year of the explosion of the first atom bomb, earlier than that, you've got the invention of LSD, which seemed to be an inner part of a kind of yin and yang alchemy. And it was this enormous explosion from the very core of reality itself and our understanding of it, balanced out, you know, these two extremes of the Nazi era, the psychedelic 60s, and it's as if the breaking down of old forms, you know, there was a unity behind these two diverse historical manifestations. Now, I know it's a very Eurocentric view. I know I'm not thinking about, you know, Asia and Africa and South America, but the fundamental events of the 20th century were surely the two world wars. And it does seem as if there is, on the one hand, something that is very dangerous and destructive and breaking down of all the things that we hold dear, but on the other hand, there's a potent liberation there as well. And the principle that Crowley outlines through all of this, that is probably the most famous saying associated with him, do what thou wilt, should be the whole of the law, is basically saying in the midst of this incredible disruption, in this changing of the eons, find out who you are, find out what you most truly are, and be that, do it, most fundamentally do it. All of that just made tremendous sense to me, and the more I thought about it, the more so many other distinctive oddities of 20th century occult culture seemed to constellate around it, and you know, that lies at the core of the whole book.
And I'm curious about your own thoughts in terms of sort of the context of the book, because as you say, viewing these events through the lens of Thelema and the Book of the Law as a prophetic text, it really affects not only the perspective, but also Thelema itself. It's almost seems like a validation somehow.
Well, my bottom line, I guess, with the Book of the Law and the idea of the Eon Horus is that the very least it can be said to be is a superb poetic metaphor for the tumult of the 20th century that has been so problematical for people to get an emotional handle on, to know how to deal with it and how to relate to it. I think the very least we can say is that Crowley, by virtue of his extreme experience, temperament, preparation, understanding, was able to pick up some signals that were being screened out from, you know, the consensus at that period of time. Certainly in 1904, if you'd have said that the whole world was going up in flames and that all of Western civilization was about to have the carpet pulled out from under it, not that many people would necessarily have bought into that. You know, certain artists and thinkers, poets and whatnot, had a sense of unease during the so-called fin de siècle period. But the First World War, nobody, I think, really could have remotely prophesied that something that vast was coming. And yet, I think, in, you know, maybe you can say that it's a retrospective thing, but you can see that in the Book of the Law. You can certainly, in my opinion, see the Nazi nightmare and, you know, elements of all of that in chapter 3.
I'd like to spend a few minutes just speaking a little bit more about Crowley, obviously the central figure of the book.
Yeah.
He is very enigmatic, very intriguing, even alluring figure, but much more complex than many portrayals make him out to be. And I'd like if you could give us a little bit of a taste of the vast complexities of this man and some of the things that make him so unique and special.
Well, I think the first thing that ever actually appealed to me, that interested me about Crowley, was the multifaceted nature of his personality and his life. You know, even if it was just a case of looking at a whole bunch of photos of him spread over a period of decades, you know, all of those different personas. So you've got a guy who to most of us now, we think of him as an occultist. We think of him as a hardcore occultist. And we maybe are aware that he certainly experimented, ultimately to his detriment, with an enormous amount of drugs. You know, he's a drug pioneer. He's a psychedelic pioneer. And there's a lot of insight in those early writings on drugs, for example. Here's a guy who was involved with, for example, peyote mescaline decades before Aldous Huxley or Timothy Leary. And because of his knowledge of comparative religion, of mysticism, and his own engagement in various practices, his insights into these altered states of consciousness are very intriguing. So you've got a guy who, in the first decade of the 20th century, as well as setting world mountaineering records, you know, climbing 22,000 feet in the Himalayas without oxygen, which is something that, you know, debauched degenerates, as the Crowley enthusiast Gerald Suster once said, don't set world mountaineering records. You know, we think of this guy as being perhaps, you know, a drug fiend. We're aware of the fact that he had a prodigious polymorphous sexuality. But if we think of some of the other people in the culture who we might look at in that way, we can't imagine Sid Vicious or Quentin Crisp 22,000 feet up the Himalayas without oxygen. At the same time as this, within a few years of all of this, Crowley is actually out in India learning yoga, you know, directly from Indian teachers. You know, there are accounts in his diaries from, I think, 1903, when he was on a retreat in Ceylon and he was doing pranayama practices, that's yoga breathing, for anything up to 8 hours a day. Now, if you're just some dilettante, if you're just somebody who's just a dabbler, a charlatan, an egotist, you are not going to persist to that extent. You simply aren't going to do it. And there's no indication that the guy is falsifying his own diaries to big himself up or in any way, you know, lying about the nature of his self-discipline. As well as that, yeah, he's the magician, certainly, and he blends together in that first decade of the 20th century the practices of yoga and disciplines that he's got from the East and the embodiment, as it was at that time, of the Western mystery tradition, the teachings of the Golden Dawn. You know, he mixes these things, the Kabbalah, the knowledge that you get of the internal anatomy, the subtle anatomy for the yogic system, the chakras, blends that all together. He's also a very good chess player to the standard of virtually a grandmaster. And one of the great anecdotes that's told about him is the fact that he could play blindfold chess. He could keep two games of chess on the go in his head and do pretty well at them, play two opponents and usually win, which indicates, you know, a degree of concentration and visualization that is entirely uncommon. As well as that, there's an absolute Niagara Falls outpouring of endless poetry. Now, the poetry is something that's perhaps a bit contentious, depending on what your taste in literature is. I think there are many people who will say that he wasn't a great poet in the way that somebody like a W.B. Yeats or a T.S. Eliot was a great poet. But these poems are often about mystical, magical practices. They're often hymns of devotion to various deities. They're explorations of the inner experiences that come through the training in the Golden Dawn. And they're all about altered states of consciousness. And for people that have never even had a twinge of those altered states, they are going to maybe seem a bit pretentious and verbose. But if you approach them with the right attitude and try and capture something of the emotion that's present in them, and this was very important to Crowley, he was enraptured by his mystical processes, then I think you can appreciate him. I do like Crowley's poetry, and it's very interesting to contemplate Israel Regardi, his opinion of Crowley's mysticism, as he gives it in his famous book, Behind the Triangle. He considers him to be one of the great mystics of all time. He compares him to the Indian Ramakrishna, who was somebody famous for the fact that whatever he turned his attention to, whatever deity from whatever tradition, whether it was Christ or Allah or Kali, he would always achieve his samadhi. He would always get extraordinary ecstatic transformations from this. And Crowley seems to be another person. And because of the fact that he's living an everyday life in a way that we in the West can kind of identify with, that he's not necessarily always out on some retreat in the desert or in some monastery, that he might just be chilling out in Paris and playing a game of billiards and having a romantic entanglement at the same time as invoking his holy guardian angel. There's something there that I think is inspirational. He's one of the first people, for example, to become familiar with a whole bunch of the Eastern scriptures that many of us come to awareness of decades later, like the I Ching, the Tao Te King, the Gita, the Dhammapada, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, all this stuff. And all of this is continually, you know, blended together through this alchemy of his idea of this new eon and do what thou wilt. Find your true will. And the finding of that true will is intimately connected with this procedure of the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, which he himself recognised was an archaic bit of terminology, and something that would offend the rationalists. But for those people that have got even the slightest affinity for such processes, the mere term, the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, has a strange resonance. It immediately perhaps puts you into an altered state of consciousness and gets you thinking, as Spensky used to term it, in other categories. This man is so multifaceted. 20 years ago, I had the pleasure of seeing Robert Anton Wilson lecture, and I asked him a question. I said, do you consider Aleister Crowley to be a pioneer of quantum psychology? And he said, yeah. He definitely did, and then he went ahead to give his own exposition in a typical RAW manner of the way in which Crowley is able to take on multiple realities and deal with them and blend them together to his own greater purpose in a way that the science of the early 20th century, the multiple perspectives that we get on reality from the work of the futurists and the cubists, the way that in the new physics, we know that depending on how we look at it, depending on how we measure it, waves or particles, you know, what is light ultimately? Heisenberg is in his uncertainty principle, you know, we don't know whether the cat's alive or dead until we open the box. All these kind of things that many people out there in consensus reality still haven't taken on board. They need to be dealt with by the development of a profound and unusual psychology of fluidity and multiple perspectives. Crowley lays it all on the line in the first decade of the 20th century, you know, and that was always inspirational to me. I never, although I do feel that he made significant mistakes in terms of the extent to which he got into cocaine and heroin and such like, I've never really had that sense of him being a dark, sinister figure in the way that so many other people have done. You know, that incredible multiplicity and that unity behind the multiplicity is a bubbling humour that is ever present in all of this is the thing that communicated itself to me and certainly, you know, I felt was something that I tried to bring that sense of him all the way through into the writing of the book.
Yeah, I think you did an excellent job of that. And it's interesting that you raised the dark and sinister aspect that so many people seem to identify with Crowley by prophesying.
Well, I think it's more of a case of he showed us the nature of the dark time and also what that essentially means on an individual and a collective level if we take his magical mythology on board. A theme that runs all the way through my book, and it's a really fundamental theme, is the so-called crossing of the abyss, which is quite a hot potato in terms of to what extent occultists attribute, you know, any meaning or reality to this process. But basically, the magical grade system of attainment that Crowley took on from the Golden Dawn and slightly adjusted in his own magical practices has you moving up the Kabbalistic tree of life, a sphere at a time, taking on various practices, assimilating them into your own transformation. And there comes a point before you hit the top where you've got to cross something called the abyss. And the abyss, it involves the dissolution and the letting go of all that you've held dear and maybe all the achievements that you've actually worked through even to get to that point. It's certainly about ego dissolution. And perhaps even more famous than the event in Cairo in terms of the legend of Crowley the Occultist is the whole story of how he crossed the Algerian desert with his disciple and lover, the poet Victor Neuberg, working their way through John Dee and Edward Kelly's Enochian system, and how they, in a remarkable ceremony, invoked the Lord of the Abyss, the Guardian of the Abyss, Kuronzon, and Crowley appears to have attempted to invoke this force of dissolution and dispersal and lies and just, you know, absolutely everything that seems to be at the core of what is wrong with the world. You know, John Dee first really named this force back in Elizabethan time seems to have understood it in a not dissimilar way to the Christian idea of the serpent in the garden. Crowley takes this on into himself, and it's a matter of great controversy as to whether he successfully dealt with it and came out the other side to become, you know, a world teacher and a man on a higher level of the game, or whether he was ultimately destroyed by it. It seems as if this dramatizes something that's happening in the collective life of humanity, that there is some, you know, what Conrad characterises as the heart of darkness, maybe what Jung calls the shadow. There is some part of the human psyche that has to be faced full on, that can't be avoided anymore, because if it is avoided, then all the wars, all the horrors, all the accelerated insanity of all the corruption in various institutions and in the way that human beings relate to each other will just persist. There is something that somehow has to radically change the whole game. And maybe that's happening on a collective level, and maybe that the great mythos of 2012, whether it's coming from a sort of Ozael Gwely's end, or whether it's coming from the Terence McKenna psychedelic apocalypse exponential acceleration end, there's some enormous great quantum leap that is to occur, and around all of that there is a massive amount of fear and all the old forms that, you know, maybe are up for transformation, they dig in all the more deeply and they make all sorts of sinister growling noises and they hold their ground and they make even more trouble. And you can just see this in so many places. And I think that Crowley's magical career, at least on one level of the game, dramatizes that. You know, what he tried to come to terms with in the Algerian desert as the energy of Caronzo and in his own life as part of the unfolding of the Ian Ahurus was something that we're all clued into. And I've certainly derived a lot of, you know, emotional power from contemplating those issues. It's just a way of finding the metaphors, finding the poetry, finding what it takes to fully engage you emotionally rather than just in a dry intellectual manner with the extraordinary business of what is actually unfolding right now and what your attitude towards it should be.
Your host is Greg Kaminsky, and this is A Cult of Personality.
One of the things I wanted to touch upon is in your book you discuss World War II and the rise of Nazi Germany. Obviously, there's many occult connections there, this whole radicalization of theosophical theory that I think referred to often as Ariosophy.
Yeah.
And the way that these ideas were, I would say, co-opted for racial and Nazi purposes. But it goes much deeper than that. And you really talk about this magical subtext and the effect that it had on the population of Germany. I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about the rise of the Nazis and the occult connections that are undeniable, really.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, first of all, I would say Nazi occultism has become almost a genre in its own right, and the internet's absolutely flooded out with all kinds of material, plenty of which I find to be extremely dubious. If you want a one-stop source text to really get the lowdown from a reliable academic point of view, you can do no better than Nicholas Goodrich Clark's The Occult Roots of Nazism.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a book written by an academic of considerable credibility with exactly the right mindset to deal with this material. He focuses on that period of time that stretches probably, I would say, from the Findersichel end of the 19th century into that period that takes us up to the First World War and then the very early days of the rise of the Nazi Party, where you've got this Ariosophical blend coming together in primarily, I mean, there's two main movers in all of this, Guido von List and Adolf Lanz von Liebenfels. And List is an extraordinary character, really. A person of prodigious creativity and somebody who's very much a nature mystic, spent a lot of time wandering about, was a pioneer, alpine mountaineer. He was, I think, a member of a university rowing team. He used to go out on these solitary hikes and got very mystical about the German landscape, rune lore, all of the ancient Norse mythology. And in the early years of the 20th century, he had an experience where he had to have an eye operation, a cataract operation, I think it was, which meant that for the best part of an entire year, he had his eyes bandaged up. And this is an ordeal that has a certain amount of resonance with Odin losing an eye for the sake of the knowledge of the runes. And during that time, he went through a series of unusual inner experiences where he seemed to get visionary glimpses of a German past and apparently some kind of psychic contact with what he believed to be a long-lost Germanic sacred priesthood. I suppose if you think of the sort of mythology that you've got around the Druids in Great Britain, this was like a Germanic version of that, and he came to believe that he was the last in the line and that he was the holder of the knowledge. And from that point on, he kind of re-enters the fray, filled with this kind of mission to spread the word. And the timing of it is such that he's had decades of reading up all the folklore and being brought up in Austria, around Vienna, in a climate where there's a burgeoning anti-Semitism. Blavatsky's works get translated into German beginning of the 20th century. So he takes this mix into this strange mystical period of where he's just completely inward turned. And the thing that fascinated me, you know, as I was writing the book, was to kind of cross-reference the amount of people during the same broad period of time, about 10 years or so, who were all experiencing unusual states of consciousness. Crowley's in Cairo, communicating with this entity called IWAS, and List is believing himself to be in communion with this German priesthood. I've got to admit, although his anti-Semitism is abhorrent, there's something about List that is quite appealing. You kind of feel that in another context, in another time, if something had just been slightly different, although he could be considered to be a bit of a crank and an eccentric, there's something quite appealing about him. Whereas Lanz von Liebenfels, to me, is an entirely unappealing character. He'd been in a monastery, the Holy Cross, on the outskirts of Vienna, one of the oldest functioning monasteries in the world, actually. And his teacher had been an incorrigible anti-Semitic sort of person who'd put all sorts of strange stuff in his head. And Liebenfels had left the monastery and written an absolutely barking mad book called Theozoology, in which he'd basically evidenced an obsession with race and sex and believed that, and this is influenced by Blavatsky, that a whole bunch of references in the Bible and the literature of classical ancient cultures to various strange little weird creatures like dwarfs and mermen and things like that were actual references to and other races of real creatures that had once been alive. And they were sort of the result of the white German Aryan races breeding with lower humanity, which is basically everybody on the planet apart from white Germans, and that these sodomite apelings, as he described them, had wreaked havoc down through the ages. And he even interpreted the crucifixion of Jesus as Jesus being outraged by sodomite hobgoblins. Now, the thing, when you read it, it's all online. You can find it online, and it's I challenge anybody to read it all the way through. It's not a long book, but it's certainly so racially obsessed as to be very difficult to read. But it's also about as mad as anything you're ever going to cast your eyes upon. But the appalling thing about it is that the way that Liebenfels felt about things, that there should be a strict breeding program where Germans should not breed with any other races, that various laws should ensure that, you know, women stayed in the home and just churned out however many children and just got on with that, and that other races should be turned into slaves, that there should be mass sterilisation and extermination of other races. Liebenfels goes on to found an Order of the New Templars, and in 1907 he purchases a little castle and raises a swastika flag from it on Christmas Day. And there's no doubt at all in my mind, it's pretty clear that later on the SS take a lot of inspiration from this, that there is something that follows through there. And the crazy things that he's talking about within a few decades become, you know, policy. So they're the kind of roots of it. But most of us who've come to the genre of Nazi occultism haven't necessarily come immediately through those details. We've probably started off reading books like The Spear of Destiny or Mourning the Magicians. Now, I've given Mourning the Magicians its general approach quite a lot of time. It's very fundamental in the Crowley book, and it's worth clarifying my position there, because really the whole genre of Nazi occultism started with this book, which was published in France, I think in 1960, right on the cusp anyway. One of the most successful occult books ever, filled up with a whole range of mind-blowing topics that really did land well with the burgeoning psychedelic generation, and a substantial piece on the whole topic of Nazi occultism. The thing about this book is there's a tremendous amount of details in there which have now passed into what I'd call internet mythology, and they get repeated in loads of other people's books. But when you look into them, the details are shot full of holes and you simply can't back it up at all. I mean, a real good example is the story that 1,000 corpses of Himalayan origin were found by the Russians in Berlin in the final days of the war. This story, you see it all over the place. I've never been able to trace it further back than Mourning the Magicians. I've never seen it in any standard history of the fall of Berlin. You'd think something like this would have generated all kinds of photographs and interest, and you never get it any further than that. There's tales of an enormous colony of Tibetans in Berlin from 1926 onwards. You know, bear in mind the Nazis hadn't even come to power until 1933. One of them is this clairvoyant guy, the man with green gloves. He's passed into internet mythology. You can't pin any of it down. So if the book is so shot full of holes and all of this section is full of these inaccurate details, what is it about it that particularly appeals to me? And it is the mood that it sets. You know, the authors, Louis Powles and Jacques Bourgier, very, very cultured, very interesting, very distinctly French. You know, I think one of them had known the founder of Surrealism, André Breton. They'd got a background between them, having studied the likes of Gurdjieff and René Guénon. Bourgier had been in a concentration camp. They knew a lot about physics and so on. And they had this phrase, this idea, as it's translated into English, fantastic realism, that when you assemble a whole bunch of ideas and information together, it serves to perhaps undermine and transform your sense of consensus reality and what you are seeing around you and how you feel about it, in much the same way that one of the purposes of the Surrealist movement was perhaps to give you that sense that there is something just out of sight, something that is very fundamental and protean and unconscious, but trying to make itself conscious continually at work behind the scenes, and the reality that you think is a consensus is not that at all. It's just like some kind of film set, and behind the fronts of all of those buildings, something else is going on altogether. And what they give you is just a sense of strangeness, the sense that in Nazi Germany it was as if a radically different civilization had been brought into being that was so at odds with the rest of the world that we haven't come to terms with it yet. And that in all of that, the irrational, broke forth. And I turned to somebody like Jung to kind of flesh that out, because Jung had certainly sounded the warning back in the 30s when he'd written an essay on the Germanic deity Wotan, and felt that this powerful deity, this profound archetype in the race and unconscious of the German race, was stirring and essentially being channeled by Hitler, who was, to all intents and purposes, a shaman. And the Wotan archetype, on the one hand, can bring inspiration. There's an awful lot that's good about it, but there's also that darker side, because we may remember that the Viking shock troops were called the berserkers. You know, they ingested these alkaloid herbs. And they then went on to inflict extraordinary carnage, and that there's something of that, something that's completely non-rational, that is there in the background of the Nazi era. So my sense of that is a sense of that mood, you know, the vastness of the Nuremberg rallies, the use of the symbol of the swastika, the use of archetypal mythology from German history and the Grail romances, along with that sense that you've got a bunch of people in the background who are not in a normal state of consciousness. One of the great theorists of the Nazi era was, strange enough, a British guy called Stuart Chamberlain. And he'd written a book called The Foundations of the 19th Century back in the 1890s. And he'd been virtually possessed, you know, he'd been on a train trip, I think in Italy, and he'd simply had to get out of the train and shut himself up in a hotel room for 8 days, and he just wrote this book in what was described as the grip of a fever, of a trance, a state of self-induced intoxication. And when he read the result of it, he scarce even recognised it as his own work. And this was all about race and history and Jesus being a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Aryan and the destiny of the German race. So here's a guy that's, you know, right there, accepted a friend of the Kaiser, actually, somebody that was there in the background of the First World War, accepted by Hitler as one of the founders, essentially, of the Nazi Party. You've got Guido von List believing himself to be in communication with discarnate, you know, inner plane adepti, the ancient Armin and priesthood. And then obviously you've got Hitler himself at the end of the First World War, at the time of the German defeat. He's blinded in a gas attack. You know, it's another one of these motifs of somebody being shut off and put into their own inner experience. And some enormous indeterminate experience comes upon him whereby at that point he takes on to himself the idea that he is going to be, you know, the man to save the German nation. And in all of this, you know, there's very, very powerful emotion and altered states of consciousness at work. And this is before we even get anywhere near the likes of Heinrich Himmler and the Nazis' Grail Castle at Babelsberg, you know. So there's an otherworldly mood that, when you contrast it with what was happening in Britain, you know, I don't know to what extent over in the States people have got a sense of the British culture of the 1930s. It wasn't very funky, you know. Neil Chamberlain was a pretty undynamic kind of leader in comparison to the Messianic Führer. And, you know, the Wagnerian operas and the whole intensity of the Nazi culture were very much at odds with British consensus reality. So I felt that, you know, that establishing that sense of, however much it's interpreted as, you know, a standard totalitarian regime, people might compare it and say, yeah, it's not that different from Stalin's Russia. In my opinion, it is. In my opinion, there is an extremely strange atmosphere about the whole thing, which no consensus interpretation along the normal economic lines or whatever can do justice to. And that's something that I felt from when I was, you know, a young child first seeing films of Nuremberg rallies on TV and something like that. They just brought me out in goose pimples, and there was always the sense that Hitler was somebody that was quite incredibly strange, that there was nobody else quite like him, and that he had a charisma that cannot be explained in normal terms. And even, you know, his first biographer, Alan Bullock, you know, noted British historian, talked in terms of the art of, you know, an African witch doctor or a shaman or a medicine man, and his ability to bewitch an audience and so on. there was this sense that the normal categories just didn't do justice to the situation. So that's something that I've pondered on and filled my head up with for 30 years. I wrote a dissertation on the subject when I was still at university, and it was very, very satisfying when I came to write the Crowley book that I did manage to incorporate a few little pieces from that university dissertation almost verbatim into one or two of the pages. So there's a satisfying continuity with the ongoing understanding that I've tried to be cultivating of these topics.
Yeah, it definitely really adds quite a dimension to the book. It's really a fundamental part of it. And one of the things I wanted to ensure we covered while we still have time is the anti-Nazi activity, specifically with regard to Crowley. It seems like there's significant evidence that not only was he connected with those in the intelligence services, but perhaps it was more than just circumstantial connections.
This whole side of things has been coming more and more to the fore in recent years. There's certain bits of what I call occult gossip that have been circulating about his possible involvement in the Rudolf Hess mystery. Mm-hmm. A self-proclaimed son of Crowley called Amado Crowley had written a few books and discussed an apparent ceremony that Crowley himself had arranged in a forest with some soldiers that had been set up, you know, alongside the secret elements of the Ministry of Defence to somehow try and lure Rudolf Hess to this country. All of that, to me, doesn't ring true in the slightest. I don't think it's his style. I don't really think anything like that did happen. But we certainly do know as a matter of historical record, that when Hitler's deputy Rudolf Hess came to Britain on his entirely enigmatic solo mission in May 1941, that one of the people that was there or thereabouts with the interrogation of Hess and keeping an eye on him was Ian Fleming, later to become famous as the creator of James Bond. And there is some correspondence that exists between Crowley and Fleming, because they did know each other, where Crowley basically offers his services, you know, having heard that, you know, if it's true that Hess is interested in astrology and so on, maybe he might be of some use in helping to interrogate him. So this suggests the tip of the iceberg scenario. Obviously there's some sort of prior relationship of a kind between Crowley and Fleming. There's all sorts of suggestions that some of the inner circle of the MI6 intelligence community, such as Fleming himself, the author Dennis Wheatley, Maxwell Knight, who was the inspiration behind the M character in James Bond, the extent to which they knew Crowley, you know, they certainly would have lunch with him and things like that and would talk to him about magic and so on. The general consensus is that Crowley was never actually brought in to interrogate Rudolf Hess, but it's one of those irresistible things where you think, well, you know, if he wasn't, then he damn well ought to have been, and somebody should write an art house play of some kind about, you know, what would have happened if the two of them had been, you know, sitting across an interrogation table, talking to each other. There's a few little rumours, you know, they're gorgeous rumours, and I had to include them in the book with the, you know, the full perspective that they are rumours. There is a suggestion that maybe Crowley did interrogate Hess after all. We know that the mental state of Hess in the Nuremberg trials, very controversial. Some people have even suggested it wasn't him at all, it was a double. It seems like the guy's brain was a bit fried. At one point during his incarceration in 1941, he complained to Red Cross officials that were bringing him food packages and so on, that he was being fed Mexican brain poison, which we would have to interpret as mescaline. Now, bearing in mind that there's, you know, one person on the outskirts of the situation in the form of Crowley, we know is a bit of a pioneer and adept of exactly such substances, it makes you wonder. You know, it's irresistible. There is that sense of some other level of the game intruding there. We do know from Crowley's diaries that within days of the war breaking out, he went for an interview with Naval Intelligence. There's a whole side to his life involving espionage that is incredibly fascinating. It does seem really that throughout the whole of his adult life, he was constantly in the company of, or there or thereabouts, with people who had links to the intelligence community. And there was a book called Secret Agent 666, which came out a few years ago, which puts forward all sorts of very interesting suggestions as to what that might mean. I mean, for me, one of the most extraordinary occasions that we can wonder quite what's going on is when in 1925, Crowley's in Germany, he's vying to be the completely acknowledged head of the Magical Order, the OTO. He's involved in a lot of work in Germany, and he has a meeting with Erich Ludendorff. Ludendorff was one of the top military commanders in Germany in the First World War and later went on to become an early supporter of Hitler, who's involved in the Munich Putsch. He had some sort of odd mystical ideas himself. But there's no question that Crowley met him and kind of had some sort of convivial little lunch of some kind with him. And you just wonder, bearing in mind this is 1925 and Crowley has gone through only quite recently his period of exceptional notoriety in the British press. You know, he's been expelled from Mussolini's Italy, from the Abbey of Thelema. The whole wickedest man in the world, man we'd like to hang, black magician mythos, is hanging in the air around him, and yet somehow he manages to have lunch with a person of the status of Ludendorff. You do wonder, you know, there is an enormous backdrop that we're not properly seeing there. And stories that he later tells of the fact that he produced pro-German propaganda during his time when he lived in America during the First World War, that actually was working for British intelligence. Whilst that kind of stuff wasn't necessarily believed a few decades ago, now it's starting to look more and more as if this could be true. So in terms of the Second World War, there's no doubt at all, you know, there are people who've suggested that Crowley was, in some respects, a Nazi, that Hitler was a follower of Crowley. We do know that one of Crowley's followers in Germany, a woman called Martha Kunzel, did send a copy of the Book of the Law to Hitler, but Hitler got an awful lot of mail. You know, Hitler was the most mailed person in Germany. There was a whole team of people dealing with Hitler's mail. It's not like there was a kind of, a letterbox at Berchtesgaden garden and a little package of the Book of the Law would have popped through it and Hitler would have opened it with his breakfast one morning and had a look at it. It just doesn't work that way. And yet to read some people, you would think that it did. It is interesting that Martha Kunzel, later on, members of the OTO in Germany got hassled. They ended up in concentration camps. She didn't. I'm not quite sure. You know, maybe there's a little bit of a mystery there. But Crowley was absolutely unequivocal about his opposition to Hitler and the Nazis when the Second World War broke out. We know, you know, we're probably going to go on to talk about Dion Fortune a bit later. A few years beyond the so-called magical battle of Britain, there's a little bit of extant correspondence between Dion Fortune and Alistair Crowley. And Dion Fortune asked Alistair Crowley, "How shall I visualise Mr. Churchill?" You know, that's another one of these tips of the iceberg. There's a few photographs that are getting quite well known now where Crowley seems to be imitating Winston Churchill. He's smoking a big cigar, he's got a particular type of hat on, he looks like Winston Churchill. there's a whole thing there that's distinctly mysterious. You know, we certainly know plenty about Dion Fortune. We don't know quite as much about Aleister Crowley's role in all of this, but I'm not in any doubt about whose side, you know, he ultimately was on when it came down to it.
Well, I want to give us an opportunity to wrap up here for this section.
Yeah.
Paul, I want to, first of all, thank you for sharing with us, because I think your book, Aleister Crowley and Aeon of Horus, is one of the most interesting, thought-provoking, and wide-ranging, I want to stress that point, that talks about Crowley, his life, Thelema, the implications of it, how Crowley, his life, and these concepts can be used as a lens through which to view our reality. And I think it's a unique book in that respect, and I really appreciate that very much. And I wanted to give you an opportunity, if you had any final thoughts for people listening or anything.
Okay,
like,
well,
that.
If you're interested in the book and you're in the States, it's being handled by Wiser Antiquarian. Anywhere else in the world, the book has got its own website, which is www.alistaircrowley666.co.uk. You know, there are extracts in the book there, and you can buy the book from it with postage for anywhere in the world. I'm on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I'm fairly easy to find in that respect and communicate with. And I've got a new website, which is paulwestonglastonbury.com, where there's going to be all sorts of things on there, extracts from my book, and also ongoing lists of events. If you're in the UK, whether that's in London or more in the Glastonbury area, I do give quite a lot of public lectures and so on. And obviously, Blog Talk Radio, I think my show's down as Paul Weston 1, the Avalon and Eon show. I've done a few of them now, and I'll be doing more in time to come. Certainly there's some interesting stuff there on Magical Battle of Britain, on Crowley and Jung as well, which is one of my favourite subjects in the book. But yeah, check out my own book website, and you can also find, you know, I've done two other books. Avalonian Eon was the original work from which the other two were hived off. AvalonianEon.com, and then Mysterium Artorius is my Arthurian Glastonbury Grail book, which is a far slimmer volume. Crowley's about 400 pages. Avalonian Eon's 540 pages, but Mysterium Artorius, which has also got its own website at .co.uk, that's just 120 odd pages of extreme density. That includes the Dion Fortune, wartime working meditation, which I think we'll be talking about a little more later. Right. I've also got Paul Weston's Avalonian Eon Publications fan page on Facebook, and there's a storefront there. You can get the books there as well. I've now got a friend of mine who's got Avalonian Eon and Mysterium Artorius in quantity in the States, and she's got them up on Amazon, and also there's a search inside facility on Amazon, so you can have a little bit of a look at all three of my books on Amazon should you choose to do so.
Excellent. So thank you again, Paul, and I hope people will tune in for the second part of our conversation and meditation.
And thank you, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Paul Weston discusses the work of Dion Fortune during the Battle of Britain in World War II. Included is a historically based and powerful guided meditation by Paul entitled A Glastonbury Kabbalah. Be sure to check out that amazing recording.
The Pentagram, dedicated to Henry Farnham. In the years of the primal force and the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horse, And man was the lord of the earth. He made him an hollow skin from the heart of an holy tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigor of steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire. He drove the celestial team, and man was the lord of the fire. Deep mouthed from their throne, deep seated, the choirs of the eons declare the last of the demons defeated. The man is the lord of the air. Arise, O man, in thy strength, the kingdom is thine to inherit, till the high gods witness at length that man is the lord of his spirit.